Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. Anthony Scaramucci, a former hedge fund manager, is the new White House communication chief, and Sean Spicer, the press secretary and acting communications director, has now resigned. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, immediately named by Scaramucci as Spicer's successor. President Trump's legal advisors are said to be looking into possible conflicts of interest within special counsel Robert Mueller's investigative team that could use to discredit Mueller's inquiry into Russian election meddling. VOA White House correspondent Peter Heinlein has that story.
The New York Times reports Trump aides are conducting wide-ranging checks into the professional and political ties of the team Mueller has assembled for his Russia probe. The checks are said to be in preparation for what is described as a looming showdown between the president and Mueller. The Trump team is said to be scrutinizing everything from donations to Democratic Party candidates by investigators to the personal relationship between Mueller and former FBI Chief James Comey, whom Trump fired. A member of Trump's outside legal team, Jay Sekulow, said the lawyers will consistently evaluate the issue of conflicts and raise them in the appropriate venue, even complaining to Mueller directly if needed. Peter Heinlein, VOA News, The White House.
The Washington Post reporting that Russia's ambassador to the U.S. told his supervisors in Moscow that he discussed campaign-related matters with Attorney General Jeff Sessions last year during the presidential election season, contrary to what Sessions has said. Sessions said in his February confirmation hearing before the Senate that he did not recall having any contact with Russian officials while acting as Mr. Trump's foreign policy advisor last year. This is VOA News. Israeli officials say three Israelis died and one more wounded when a Palestinian broke into a home in a West Bank settlement and stabbed the inhabitants while they were eating dinner. Two of the victims died Friday soon after the attack in an area north of Ramallah. Another victim died later in the day. The assailant was shot by Israeli police and is hospitalized in Israel. He has been identified as 20-year-old Omar El-Abed, his brother also arrested. A U.S. counterinsurgency airstrike has mistakenly killed at least 15 Afghan security forces, confirmed an Afghan defense ministry Saturday. The deadly strike came after a Taliban suicide car bomb attack destroyed the same post just before the insurgents carried out their assault. Taliban sources, meanwhile, claim that one of the three bombers who carried out the suicide attack was the son of a fugitive chief of the Islamist insurgency. An al-Qaeda suspect accused of supporting terrorists made his initial appearance in a U.S. federal court in Philadelphia Friday following his extradition from Spain. Ali Sharif Damash was indicted in 2011 in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania on charges that he aided terrorism, including a plan to kill a Swedish artist who depicted the Prophet Muhammad as a dog. Authorities believe Damash conspired with an American woman who was known as Jihad Jane to recruit people to carry out terror attacks in Europe and Asia. Damash, who was known online as Black Flag, is the first foreigner brought to the United States to face terrorism charges under the Trump administration. President Trump Saturday commissioned the USS Gerald R. Ford, a nearly $13 billion warship, after 3 years of delays and billions of dollars in cost overruns. When he delivered the keynote address at a ceremony in the southeastern coastal city of Norfolk, Virginia, the new carrier will be the flagship of the new class of supercarriers, the first new class in 40 years and most expensive warships ever built. The president said the power of this ship will send a message.
Wherever this vessel cuts through the horizon, our allies will rest easy and our enemies will shake with fear, because everyone will know that America is coming, and America is coming strong.
The ship will have a lifespan of 50 years, and its nuclear power plant will allow it to operate for 20 years without a need to refuel. The Republican push to craft a health care bill to replace the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, hit another stumbling block Friday. The Senate parliamentarian is reported to have decided Republicans would need 60 votes to keep anti-abortion provisions in the bill, something they do not want and something Democrats won't allow. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Initially, there were attempts to arrest him in Dodoma, where he had gone to attend a case. There were attempts to arrest him. He successfully resisted by refusing to come out of the courtroom, so he was allowed to travel back to Dar es Salaam.
The Tanzanian Bar Association condemns the arrest of its president, Tundu Lissu.
I was disqualified on baseless grounds by RPF, Noreen Party, because they did not want to compete with me during the election.
The only female candidate disqualified from participating in the upcoming Rwandan election speaks out.
Germany decided to basically resort to brutal force to lay their hands on the fertile lands occupied by the Herero people and the Nama people of Namibia.
And two Namibian ethnic groups demand reparations and an apology from Germany over atrocities committed against their people. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Tanganyika Law Society, which is the Bar Association of Tanzania, has sharply condemned the government following the arrest of its president, Tundu Lissu, Thursday. Lissu, who is also a member of the Tanzanian parliament, was arrested after police accused him of incitement and soliciting incitement. But the Tanzanian Bar Association says the arrest contravenes the constitution, which guarantees freedom of speech and expression. Parliamentarian Tundu Lissu from the opposition party Chadema is an avowed critic of President John Magufuli. For more on his arrest, I reach his defense attorney, Peter Kibatalia, from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam.
Mr. Tundu Lissu was arrested on his way to Kigali, Rwanda, 20th of July. He was due to attend the East Africa Law Society meeting that was scheduled to commence. Initially, there were attempts to arrest him in Dodoma, where he had gone to attend a case. There were attempts to arrest him. He successfully resisted by refusing to come out of the courtroom, so he was allowed to travel back to Dar es Salaam. He was arrested, taken over to the Central Police Station in Dar es Salaam.
What were the reasons for his arrest?
The reasons were not properly expounded to him, and as a result, he even refused to give his statement, because normally, as per the law in Tanzania, when a police officer arrests you, he must tell you the reason for the arrest. In America, the equivalent is reading the Miranda rights. We spent the whole day at the police Central Police Station trying to ascertain why he has been arrested. We have not been availed with such information. So we can just basically operate on guesswork.
What is your next line of action next week?
Actually, our approach is multi-pronged, okay? Number one, since we have failed to procure the cooperation of the police in terms of either having him released on police bail or having him taken to court expediently so that his matter can be discussed in court and possibly him being admitted on bail, we filed an application in the nature of habeas corpus, which is an application for the High Court, ordering the police to show cause before the High Court why they are holding a suspect without taking him to court or without admitting him on bail. So the application has been filed. It has been served upon the Inspector General of the Police, under whose auspices all police undertakings are done. So we expect that either the police will respond to that application in between, that is today, maybe Sunday, release him on bail. If not, then we'll pursue the application in the High Court on Monday. We'll summon the Inspector General of Police to show cause why they are holding Mr. Tundu Lissu without taking him to court, because we believe if the police had time and energy and resources, to arrest him at the airport, then the presumption is they had already reasonable information to take him to court. Otherwise, why would they arrest somebody and investigate later? Because the principle is you investigate, then you arrest somebody and take him to court expediently.
He is a member of parliament. Doesn't he enjoy some form of immunity?
Normally he should, although under the strict letter of the law, he only enjoys limited immunity, particularly for acts he does in the parliamentary premises. Now, the statement that he made, if indeed that is the cause of his arrest, like I said, because nobody told us explicitly what is the reason of his arrest. If indeed the cause is the statement that he made, then the statements were made outside the parliamentary premises. So somebody could probably argue that he does not enjoy immunity in this instance. But that's not the issue here. The issue is, as the president of the Tanganyika Law Society, the Bar Association of Tanganyika, as a renowned member of parliament, he could at least be granted some sort of dignity in the investigation process and prosecution process. He could be out on bail. The police may take time to investigate whatever it is that they're investigating. When they are ready to take him to court, they take him to court. Now you can imagine, if a prominent lawyer, a member of parliament, can be treated in this way, with the possibility of spending an entire weekend in remand prison without having charges laid against him, what about a common man? And that is the major source of our complaint. That's why we went to the High Court.
His critics are saying that he has been really trading barbs with President Magufuli, sometimes undermining his authority based on statements he makes both in Parliament or the Bonga and elsewhere, and such. He deserves what is coming to him. What's your take?
I'll relate myself to a lawyer's assessment. He's a member for the opposition. He's prone to criticizing the government in power. That's the nature of the creature. That's number one. Number two, if he aims criticism, that is, I mean, unlawful criticism outside the parameters of parliament, the proper procedure is to charge him in court properly. You do not hold him unnecessarily in remand prison.
Peter Kibatalia is the defense attorney for Tanzanian parliamentarian Tundu Lissu. He spoke with me from Dar es Salaam. The Rwandan National Electoral Commission has announced plans to hold a presidential debate days ahead of the upcoming August 4 presidential vote. The debate will be broadcast live by the state broadcaster, but a date has yet to be announced. It is unclear if longtime incumbent President Paul Kagame would participate in the debate. Meanwhile, campaigns are ongoing in the run-up to the election. Diane Rigara, the only female candidate, was disqualified by the Electoral Commission from the upcoming vote. Rigara told me her disqualification shows she poses a significant threat to the government in the poll.
I was disqualified on baseless grounds by RPF, the ruling party, because they did not want to compete with me during the election. They know how much support I have within the country. They know I speak the truth. So simply, they did not want to be exposed.
Why should the ruling party be scared of an independent candidate? President Paul Kagame has been winning over 90% of the vote for a very long time now, and he's seen as going to be re-elected anyway. So why do you think they are so scared of you? They said you did not meet requirement as stipulated by the Electoral Commission in its requirement.
The required number of signatures was 600. I almost doubled it. I gave 1,105 signatures. They had no basis to disqualify me. I fulfilled all the requirements. And simply, they had to get me out. We live in a country that portrays a clean, positive image when within the country, things are not as they appear.
I understand that you did not campaign, you didn't have support, you did not hold any press conferences to announce your candidacy, to alert.
No, I did. I had about 5 press conferences, actually, between May 3rd and now. I did announce my intention to run on May 3rd during a press conference. That's how I announced my intention to run. It was during a press conference. And I had a few more after that.
Recently, you said you were stopped from holding a press conference to talk about the reasons why the Electoral Commission disqualified you. Are you legally challenging your disqualification. What's next for you?
What I have said in the past was it was hard for an individual, any individual in Rwanda, to be able to hold a press conference. Anybody from the opposition, I mean, it's hard for us to hold press conferences in hotels because the owners of those hotels are too afraid of the ruling party. So I have been having my press conferences in the last few months in my own house. And about my disqualification, the only thing I could do would be to go to court, but there's no point to that because all institutions in this country work for RPF. So what would be the point when the court system works for the ruling party? So they have tried to find different strategies to, and not just me, but even my supporters, some have been harassed, others were detained in jail, and the last thing they did was now they are in the process of closing down family businesses as a punishment for me taking a stand against the government.
People who support the government are saying those are not true and that the state institutions are just upholding the laws and that if these businesses are failing to meet tax requirement, are failing to meet standards set to regulate the industry, it is the institution that is working to clean up the system. So the accusations that the government or the ruling party is clamping down on your businesses or collapse your business is not true. What do you say to that?
Everybody knows that if you dare to speak up, if you dare to take a stand against this government, they make sure that you pay a price, a high price. And it's not just you, the person speaking out. It's also your entourage, your loved ones, your family, your friends, because in Rwanda, you are guilty by association.
Diane Rwigara was disqualified by the Rwanda National Electoral Commission from participating in the upcoming August 4 poll. She spoke with me from the capital, Kigali. Ethnic groups in Namibia are demanding an apology and reparations from Germany over atrocities committed against them. Between 1904 and 1908, tens of thousands of men, women and children from the Herero and Nama ethnic groups that stood up to German rule were killed in battle or died of starvation, cold or mistreatment in the present-day Namibia. Germany has long refused to take the blame, only accepting responsibility on the 100th anniversary of the massacres in 2004. But it ruled out the possibility of reparations. Vikui Rukoro is the paramount chief of the Herero people. I reached him in the Namibian capital, Windhoek, to learn more about their demands.
As you know, between the years 1904 and 1908, Germany decided to basically resort to brutal force to lay their hands on the fertile lands occupied by the Herero people and the Nama people of Namibia to take over their land, to take over their cattle and other properties. And Germany then simply decreed that all Herero men, women and children must simply be wiped off the face of the earth. And then they proceeded to actually execute that decree. The end result of all this is that 80% of the Herero people were actually annihilated and close to 60% of the Namas similarly wiped off the face of Namibia.
What are you pressuring the government and the German government for at the moment?
We are saying they must apologize to the Namibian people that the German government of the time committed an act of genocide. Then secondly, they must then acknowledge that they need to pay us reparations, A, for the expropriated properties in the form of ancestral lands that the German authorities took away from our parents, the hundreds of thousands of heads of cattle, movable and immovable property, which ought to have been our inheritance as of today, and which were simply expropriated without compensation.
In terms of numbers, how much money are the Rutshuru people putting on these property that you enumerated? How much money are we talking about here?
Well, it's quite a huge sum of money running into billions of dollars. At this point in time, because we are pursuing a two-pronged strategy of both negotiations, which was our initial strategy, and they simply refused. They refused to talk to us because we are a non-state entity, as they called it. We are a non-sovereign entity, even though history instructs us that in the case of the Jewish Holocaust, they actually sat down with no less than 23 Jewish non-state, non-sovereign entities alongside the State of Israel and negotiated.
Namibian government negotiator in talks with Germany, you're talking about Zed Ngaveluye, says that any meaningful agreement will be reached at state level. You don't think he's doing enough?
In terms of international law, as well as the United Nations principles on issues of genocide and the rights of victims of genocide, it's very clear that the affected people have the right to direct and substantive representation separate and distinct from their national government. And therefore, the fact that the Namibian government is talking to the Germans does not detract from the right of us as a people to sit down alongside our government and negotiate directly.
What is your second approach? Does it involve any legal representation on your part to challenge the paradigm as you have it at the moment?
Exactly. After we tried every avenue to resolve this thing through by trying to talk directly to the German government and they rebuffed us, we had no option but to resort to legal means. And after researching the various legal jurisdictions in the world, we found that the most suitable was to approach a court in the United States in New York by suing the German authorities through Kenneth McCallion and Associates. We therefore filed the necessary litigation under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, as well as other legal provisions for genocide. That's the second leg of our strategy that we are now pursuing in the courts of the United States.
Vikui Rukoro is the paramount chief of the Herero people in Namibia. He spoke with me from Vintok. Kenya is set to hold its most expensive election ever. In a new pre-election economic and fiscal report released before the August 8 polls, the Kenyan National Treasury says this year's election is expected to be Africa's most expensive on a cost-per-voter basis. The public and private spending are both at an all-time high, with both the government and candidates spending hundreds of millions of dollars to secure the electoral process or campaigning to get elected. My colleague Douglas Mpuga reached Fred Umulo, a Kenyan journalist, to find out why this election is so expensive.
This is going to be the most expensive election in Kenya's history, simply because the players are now more sophisticated. They are borrowing techniques from advanced democracies. There are new methods of reaching people through the media, the different media, whether it's print, whether it's electronic, whether it's just billboards on the streets. You need a bigger team. You need people online to push your agenda on social media and in such different places. You no longer just do posters the way we used to have it in the 80s. These days you do flyers that people walk around with. You do banners and you do T-shirts and, you know. So all these things, cumulatively, they are turning it into the most expensive election we've ever seen.
Expense aside, there are reports that the two principal participants, opponents in this election, don't seem to agree on whether the Electoral Commission is actually prepared to conduct the polls. Is that true?
To a degree, both of them are correct. The government side, which is led by the President Uhuru Kenyatta, he feels that the Electoral Commission is prepared. And rightly so, because the legal framework in Kenya's electoral system is, I think, it's the most robust in Africa. Probably you can only compare South Africa with this. Not even Ghana, which has had a better history of free and fair elections than Kenya, has such a robust system. So they are so confined, and the system that pushes them towards transparency and all the limiting and confining rules of engagement have made the Electoral Commission to be a little bit more under the spotlight. They are under more scrutiny. And if you look at the elections that come in between the general election comes once every 5 years where we replace everyone or we re-elect everyone. But in between, if you look at the occasions when they have to hold mini elections, maybe a representative has died or someone has resigned or someone has been jailed, you look at the way they conduct those mini elections and it's always flawless. And most of the time, it is never challenged in court. So to a degree, the systems and the structures are there, and the Electoral Commission is probably most prepared than in its entire history. But if you look at the way that they're trying to use loopholes, and this is where the opposition principal, Raila Odinga, comes in, they've been trying to use too many loopholes to conduct their processes, such that if no one points it out on time, they will take advantage of the situation and they will conduct something in a sloppy manner. Case in point was the tendering for the presidential ballots, in which there were delays, there were very poor and very untransparent procurement processes, and they had to be taken to court and the court had to defend them. But every time you take the Electoral Commission to court, there's a higher chance that you will lose your case against them because of the legal backing they have.
Fred Omulo is a Kenyan journalist. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Kisumu. Women's and children's health is improving faster than at any point in history, according to the United Nations. From Washington, VOA's Carol Pearson reports on a massive program which has saved countless lives and is gaining momentum.
More women are surviving childbirth, and more children are surviving childhood, even in the poorest of nations. It's the result of a UN-backed initiative called Every Woman, Every Child. Launched in 2010, it brings together more than 800 organizations, including the World Health Organization.
More women are receiving services of care, skilled care during birth, more antenatal care, more postpartum care. Children are receiving more vaccines than ever before.
Governments and private organizations invested more than $45 billion to improve women's survival during pregnancy and childbirth. The funding helped train midwives, improve nutrition for women, children, and adolescents. It provided education, better sanitation, and clean water. The result? Since 1990, the world's maternal death rate has fallen by 44%. Another achievement, death rates of children under 5 declined by more than 50%. Together, they are great humanitarian achievements. It also makes sense economically. Governments save money that is normally spent fighting disease, and healthy people contribute more to a country's wealth. The return on investment is high.
Every kind of investment on women, children, adolescent is an immense resource for the countries and the GDP.
Nearly all preventable deaths among women, children, and adolescents occur in low- to middle-income countries. In 2015, more than 300,000 women died during pregnancy and childbirth. Most deaths could have been prevented. Also that year, nearly 6 million children under age 5 died, mainly from avoidable causes. That's 16,000 children dying every day. The goal now is to improve on the program's success. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. They just hear your pleasures because they feel the pressure. Oh, this one a bad impression. Oh, no, this one a bad impression. I'm a government, I beg. Plenty younger done the cycle. Many, many done the day. Many, many done the work. Some they follow dance at Olympia. Why some they follow sheep, they go yonder. We got these three big problems. Now who go help us conserve this problem? This thing that they hear you so now a major problem. About water, light, food, house. Water, light, yeah, food, house. Water, light, food, house. About water, light, yeah, food, house. I don't want kilo de gone on. To go as you know. Bago di luma se wa, ba se gone on. We get all yeah, no be said that say we get all yeah. For real. Plenty mineral resources in Boku for yeah. Makatuku Piko. Electricity no supposed be our problem. Oh. Be like. Now when we go go see the light of this hour tunnel. Oh. I bet time they go now, time they go. Oh no, this one now wickedness. Oh. I'm a government I beg. Younger done the cycle. Many, many done the day, oh. Many, many done the waka. Some they follow dance at Olympia. Where some they follow sheep, they go yonder. We got these three big problems. Now who go help us conserve this problem? This thing I declare you so. Now a major problem, oh. About water, light, food, house.
Hi, baby girl. Hi, angel. My girly, girly, oh, girly, eh. Hi, baby girl. Hi, angel. My girly, girly, oh, girly, eh.
Of love, I will do anything. For the sake of love, I will do anything more. Just to prove my love, I will cry you a river. For the sake of love, I pray for you, baby. Baby, you're my ecstasy. You are my fantasy. You book one on a one chance. Manu tutu mananyasi. Baby, you're my ecstasy. You are my fantasy.
You are my fantasy.
You book one on a one chance.
Yeah.
One chance. Mano tutu mana nyasi.
T, sick of love.
Yeah.
I used to play around a lot to see how my doggy concubines be bringing me penny rough.
Yeah.
The memo pa me toss so forth. See, I love your imperfections and your flaws.
Yes.
Me tisi can be a me side chick or bra me yidi tifi and come in for being so soon top blocks.
No.
In sis I can't me that iron rods. Baby, you got too much sauce. Dora, take me away. All the love that you need, I got it for you, baby. What really do you want me to say? For what I know my soon, I frame me bae. Everything gon' be okay, T. Donna me donna, so what is she a me sonno? We be from a kuma and share me doff on the corner. See, cry you a river, baby, make you no shiver. What do be there? We need to have Beyonce love on my jigger. Whining and mommy, keeping it honey. Frame me your honey, and I'ma show you the money. My feel wanna drink come on. Tima wo pemo, what we need to say, we be in Kamu, Hunti, ya, who be
my love, I will do anything. For the sake of love, I will do anything more. Just to prove my love, I will cry you a river. For the sake of love, I pray for you,
pray for you, baby.
I like that.
Baby, tell them send a lie. Say nothing can come in between us. We will fight it all. Even if we break up, we'll make up. Baby, tell them say no lie. Say nothing can come in between us. We will fight it all. Baby girl, you are my fire. Baby, you're my desire. I put the boys if I na wanya. I swear to you, then go tire. I go one person, my wugaya. To bring the change in Mwe Bugaria. And I promise you, my baby, I'll do anything for you. For the sake of love, I will do anything. For the sake of love, I will do anything, more. Just to prove my love, I will cry you a river. For the sake of love, I pray for you, baby. Baby, you're my ecstasy. You are my fantasy.
You are my fantasy.
You book one on a
one chance.
Mano tutu mana nyasi. Baby, you're my ecstasy.
My ecstasy.
You are my fantasy.
You are my fantasy.
You book one on a
one chance.
Mano tutu mana nyasi.
Anything I do for myself, I go buy a yacht for yourself. What if I build my shoe for yourself?
I'll do anything for you.
Anything I do for myself.
Tirangarire imambo zuara yenda. Dire 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 ke kukoromoka. Tirangarire imambo zuara yenda. Dire 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 ke kukoromoka.
Zagurum, Kundiani go Hakarum, Chine Meso. Chelewa, 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 mkufuzi wa mambo na chelewa, 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 mkufuzi wa mambo na chelewa. If Tonight, oh, get up, get up, get up, get up, come touch me tonight. When you see me and I see you, baby girl, say I need your love tonight. Say I don't need your love all night. Say you got me all night. Say never leave me all night. Say you got me all night.
And I go be your body like sometimes. Where I go be by your side. 10 times when I know get to see God. You be there by my side.
Baby girl, I lay your body like skin tight. So you go there by my side. Till the end of time, we go there tight. So you go there with me.
I'll never let you go.
My baby.
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Dirk Fraser, and our engineer for today, Al Santos, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, truth is like sugar cane. Even if you chew it for a long time, it is still sweet. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In support of efforts to protect fisheries in the Gulf of Mexico, U.S. Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross announced in mid-July that the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, has issued awards totaling $16.7 million from its Restore Act Science program. This year, the awardees' proposed projects support research into bluefin tuna, blue crabs, Mississippi oyster farmers, and other parts of the Gulf ecosystem. These grants highlight the vital role NOAA plays in the Gulf of Mexico, said Secretary Ross. The fisheries, which will be studied through the Restore Act Science Program, are critical to local economies along the Gulf. The Restore Act authorized NOAA to establish and administer the Restore Act Science Program, which funds programs assisting research monitoring Gulf's recovery and protecting the long-term sustainability of local fisheries to ensure that American jobs are secure far into the future. Awards will go to researchers and resource managers from 37 institutions, including universities, federal and state agencies, and non-governmental organizations. The competition focused on living coastal and marine resources and their habitats in the Gulf of Mexico. These projects will have a measurable effect on our understanding of finfish, shellfish, and other important species in the Gulf, said Dr. Julian Lartique, director of the NOAA Restore Art Science Program. Of the 15 projects, 13 are being led by institutions located in the Gulf of Mexico region. In total, 78 researchers and resource managers will be involved, with 58 of them located in the region. The awards range from over $231,000 to over $2,312,000. These projects were selected following a rigorous and highly competitive process, which included a review by a panel of outside experts. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was pleased to work with our counterparts in NOAA on this round of funding awards under the Restore Act Science Program, said Dr. Kevin Reynolds, case manager for the Department of the Interior's Deepwater Horizon Natural Resource Damage Assessment and Restoration. The cooperative spirit between our agencies ensured a focus on science that will meaningfully benefit the management of our trust resources and improve our understanding of the Gulf ecosystem.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.